This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to A Catholic's Perspective, the podcast all about being a young Catholic surviving in a secular world. Today, I have a very special guest for you. Father Robert Nixon is joining us today to discuss his new book, which is called Solitude and Silence, The Cloister of the Heart. It's a translated book from Thomas A'Kempis. And I'm just so excited to talk about this book. Welcome, Father.
Thanks very much, Amber. It's great to be with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm a huge fan of Thomas A'Kempis. And why don't you let the listeners know a little bit about yourself before we get started?
Yeah, so I'm a Benedictine monk and a priest. I'm here at the monastery at New Norcia in Western Australia. And this is the oldest religious community in Australia. We were founded way back in 1846.
Wow.
As a mission to the Indigenous people here. We're the only religious community in Australia founded by Spanish monks. And so our monastic village here is like a little piece of medieval Spain in outback Australia. And we continue today as a place of prayer, as a place of hospitality. People come here for retreats and so forth. And the monks lead the contemplative, enclosed life according to the rule of Saint Benedict. And we provide a witness to the faith for people. You know, we live according to Christian values, a life of simplicity, a life of relative austerity. And we're also a place where people can escape from the city, from the busyness of their lives, and come here and spend time in prayer and contemplation.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you guys have like retreats and stuff that people go on, or could they just visit?
No, we have retreats, absolutely. So if anyone wants to check us out, if you look up Google New Norcia and you'll come to our website, you'll see everything that goes on here. And we have a whole range of things which are going on. We see providing spiritual hospitality to people as one of our key ministries at this point in time.
That's amazing. That's so cool. I wish we had more places like that in the U.S. You know, I'm sure we do. It might just be a little hidden, but I know we have a lot of people from Australia who listen in, so maybe they'll like take a trip down there or up there, wherever you are, and just kind of visit.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing. Well, Father, I'm so excited to get into this. So for people who are watching this on YouTube, they can see the book. It is so pretty. Did you come up with this design?
You know, the people at Tan Books came up with this design, and they always produce lovely productions. So I'm very happy with what they came up for here.
I love it. It's so like, I don't know. It's just so pretty. And like you, it's a beautiful read as well. And I love just having it on my bookshelf. I'm like, oh, I want to read it. It's so pretty. And I think we need more pretty books, because the beauty of something makes you inspired to pick that thing up. And I don't think we have very many pretty books these days.
No, I mean, it makes reading it a pleasure, and it makes you realize that this book is something which you'll buy and then you'll keep for the next 20, 30, for the rest of your life, for that matter. So,
Yeah,
it's a wonderful production Tan have done, and I'm always very pleased to work with them.
That's amazing. Well, I'm so glad that you got this book out. And this isn't the first book you've translated, correct?
No, I've translated actually a whole bunch of different books for Tan. I think probably about a dozen at this point.
Wow, that's
And
amazing.
it's a great love of mine, uncovering these forgotten works which have gone unnoticed sometimes for centuries, and translating them into English. And I'm very fortunate to know Latin. And so not too many people do these days, to be able to translate it. So as a monk, I see this as part of my calling, because throughout the Middle Ages, one of the things which monks did was copy out books by hand to transmit the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And so in my own way, I'm continuing that part of our monastic vocation.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's such a, I don't, it's like you said, people don't do it these days. You go to the traditional Latin mass, people usually don't know what's going on in the mass because they don't speak Latin, but people don't realize Latin is a universal language of the church. And everyone used to know Latin so that no matter where they went in the world, they would be able to go to mass and understand it. And I think, you know, that's something that we've lost that we should really bring back. But I think it's fantastic that, you know, you're able to pair with Tan books and translate these great books. Are they the ones that provide you with the I guess the subject matter, or do you find it yourself? And, you know, how do you do that?
No, Amber, I normally find it myself, because I'm always reading very old books. Here we have in our monastery a library of over 80,000 books
Wow. Wow.
dating back to the 1400s. So it's quite an astonishing number of things that we have here, and so I explore things, and if something strikes me as being very interesting that contemporary readers would benefit from reading, then I suggest it to Tan, and they'll say, well, think about it, see if it's something they think is right for them, and then I go ahead and translate it. And so as well as translating, I kind of consider myself a bit of an archaeologist of spiritual literature of the past, that there are lots of treasures lying untranslated, and to bring them out. Because
Yeah.
of our Latin literature from the Middle Ages, I'd say less than 5% at the moment has actually been translated into English.
Oh, wow. That is a lot.
Yeah.
Like, not a lot's been
It
translated.
is indeed. Indeed,
Wow.
yeah.
Because we know of like a lot of saints whose works have been translated over the years. I mean, you know, Saint Teresa of Lisieux, and even then there's some French in her book because back then people could automatically just knew Latin and French because they learned it in school. Those were just mandatory languages to learn. But now I'll read a book from like, I don't know, an older English book or something, and there will be Latin or normally more or less French in there. And I'm just like, oh, well, nobody knows how to say that anymore unless you take French classes. So
Funnily enough, when I was a small child, this is one of the things that first made me interested in learning Latin. I loved reading Edgar Allan Poe, and he often quotes Latin, French, Greek, whatever, assuming his readers could understand it. And bit by bit, I came to value that, and to pick it up. And Latin actually isn't so hard to learn as people sometimes imagine. It's no harder than Spanish or Italian or whatever. It's just a matter of using it frequently, and then little by little it becomes ingrained, becomes perfectly natural. But
yeah.
unfortunately, that's largely been lost within our culture at this point in time.
Which is really sad because it's also such a beautiful language and people don't realize, I mean, people might, but at least these days, a lot of people don't actually realize that a lot of, you know, languages we have today are from Latin. You know, they originated from Latin and they're a little tweaked by American, you know, slang or whatever. But for the most part, most
Yeah.
of the language we have today is because of Latin.
Absolutely. It's the direct forefather of our modern languages. So I think it's a very useful thing to learn. And of course, within the church itself, you know, when you're dealing with church documents, with canon law and so forth, you look at the original to find out what does it really exactly mean. And so it's important, not to mention the liturgy. You know, liturgy, the Latin language in our liturgy is part of our cultural heritage as the Roman Catholic Church, you know. And in the same way that the Coptic Church, the Greek Church and so forth retain these things as part of their culture, so too does the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and I think that's something we've kind of lost these days. And, you know, we have this beautiful language that's such a sacred language. You know, you don't use sacred Latin outside of the Mass. And so that makes it even more special, because there's two types of Latin, correct? There's like the one that you would usually use to talk, and then there's the sacred liturgy Latin. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, kind of, Amber. You know, they're not completely distinct, but there is. And, you know, I think the celebration of, when we see the liturgy celebrated in Latin, we're reminded that it's the same throughout the world, and that it's the same liturgy that we're hearing, which the saints in previous centuries heard. So it's representing an eternal truth. And, you know, I think there's a great dignity, beauty, and nobility in that.
Absolutely. I love going to the Mass of the saints who walked the world. It just feels like such a connection to heaven. And it's just such a fun time too. I don't know. People sometimes get bored at the TLM, but I'm like, nope, I am here and I am ready to focus. It's great. But it's just such a beautiful experience. But to get into the book, I love talking about the TLM, but to get into the book, Father, could you provide like just a brief overview of this book and what inspired you to translate it?
Yeah. So he wrote this book as a kind of result of a request for someone to give them a small book which they could just dip into at different times throughout the day and would focus them. And he divides this book into two sections, one on solitude and one on silence. And these are traditional elements of the monastic life. You know, part of the idea of being monks is that we cultivate this opportunity for contemplation through solitude and through silence. But it doesn't apply only to monks. He talks about, you know, that it's in these times, in these situations, that we can most closely relate to God, who exceeds all of our words. And I think silence and solitude are something that a lot of modern people are very much deprived of, that we live in a very kind of busy and noisy culture with constant communication, constant interaction with people. Even when we're alone, we still have electronic communication and so forth. And that we need to recapture this. And that was one of the things that made me inspired to translate this book into English, you know, to give people a guide to solitude and silence. And a lot of what he says, even though he was writing back in the 14th century, still applies so much so to people today.
Yeah, I was reading it and I was just like, oh, wow, this is an exact example of what I have to go through on a daily basis. And I think it's crazy how the saints, you know, their works are truly timeless, despite the fact he lived, did you say in the 1400s or when did he live?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. The 1400s.
Born in 1380, died in about 1471. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he was like right in between there. It's like so crazy how his work still today is being used and it's accurate. Like human nature just kind of repeats itself. It can't really be changed in a certain sense. But to see Thomas Aquinas, who lived like centuries ago, be able to put a book out or a booklet, like this was technically a booklet. Well, it is a booklet, but for a friend or for a guy or something. And then later we're using it today and it's just as accurate to the world we live in today as it was back in the 1400s.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love how the saint stuff is just so timeless. Same thing with Saint Therese of Lisieux and, you know, Saint Alphonsus Liguori. But yeah, I know these days, you know, with everyone being afraid of being alone with their thoughts, you mentioned that how we live in this world of noise. Everyone has an earbud in, or they have a podcast playing in the background. The TV is in the background. Everyone seems to kind of like avoid this silence and solitude. They don't want to be in it. They're afraid to be alone with their thoughts. But why are these things so important, Father?
Because it's when we're in a state of silence and solitude that we can truly become aware of our own thoughts and feelings. And we can also truly become aware of the presence of God. You know, and the presence of God, the encounter with God in a mystical sense, is never something which is imparted to us by words or images. It's something which only comes to us as a result of entering into meditation and then contemplation and then this kind of leaving behind of all worldly things, leaving behind all the distractions of the world, ultimately leaving behind even our own thoughts and concepts and everything, to enter into communion with which is utterly beyond us. And then after we've experienced that, you know, this mystical experience of God, I think is something which a lot of people have, but it can't be then communicated to other people. You know, you can't tell other people what it was like, because it transcends words. And for that reason, we need to free ourselves from the kind of empire of words and thoughts and putting things into nameable categories and sharing things, so that we can enter into this supreme freedom in which we encounter God. And, you know, a lot of people, I think today, are led into a kind of personal shallowness because of constant communication, you know. And if you think about it, if you're having to communicate with people, you know, every waking hour, then what does that effect have on your depth of thought, on your capacity to reflect on yourself and so forth, that you find yourself just, you know, spinning words at a very superficial level. And I think that is very much the case with electronic engagement today, you know, different kinds of social media, which have become a more or less constant thing for a lot of people, especially younger people. And to recognize that this actually is a kind of tyranny. This is reducing our freedom, our personal identity, and our capacity to relate to God as individuals. Because when we want to meet with God, you know, we go into a space in which it's us alone with him alone. And when we get into that space, there's a communication taking place, but this communication is not taking place by means of words. It's a communication which transcends words of pure love. So I think that's really what we need to tap into more at this point.
I think that's beautiful, because I've always known that God speaks through silence. There's something about it where when we, and it's not just like auditory silence, it's silence in our heart too. I think a lot of the time, even when we turn off the outside world, we carry it with us and we kind of, I don't know, stew in it. And it's hard for us to come out of ourselves and to come out of the noise in our own heads because we're so overstimulated these days. And so it takes extra effort for us to have to sit down in a quiet adoration chapel and not do anything. Everyone's so hyper just into everything all the time. And it was bad when I was a kid. I remember kids having, you know, focus issues and stuff with the flip phones and the Blackberries. But now, like, 2-year-olds have smartphones. Kids have iPads at restaurants. And people think, oh, you know, my kid's fine, but they can't sit still for, like, 5 seconds. And I know kids aren't meant to sit still. But when I was a kid, I was able to focus. I was able to sit down, focus on one task. And I did that one task for at least like 30 minutes to an hour. And now kids can't even do that. It's like one thing to another to another. And as adults, when we grow up in that way and all that chaos, we never find peace. So our soul is restless until it rests in Christ, as Saint Augustine says. But at the same time, you know, if we are turning the phones off, but we're not also turning off the chaos in our own minds, we're not making much progress. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we can't turn off the chaos in our mind in just an instant. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a bit like water being stirred up. If you wait for long enough, it will reduce. It will come and settle. But, you know, you need to be patient for that to happen. And so, you know, I think that we need to commit ourselves to extended periods of silence and solitude to get into the habit of being able to shut off these thoughts and distractions. And, you know, I think it's also a very useful thing to observe what it is which is distracting us when we're alone. You know, what are the thoughts which come to us when we've got nothing to do, when we're just kind of sitting there? And this can be a very useful diagnostic tool because it can reveal to us what is our source of anxiety or concern and so forth.
Even
in itself, the silence, you know, is teaches us something about ourselves. You know?
Yeah, I think that's...
And this is so important.
Yeah, I think that's important because I think with silence these days, people have always asked me, like, why doesn't God speak to us like he does in the Old Testament? And I'm like, because we have so much noise. Back then, all they had to worry about was, like, sheep baaing and stuff. And, like, now we have cars and, you know, all this stuff. And, I mean, it's probably not the only reason, of course. But, you know, we hear of these beautiful moments of God coming to people. And usually it's in prayer or it's in a moment in life where that person's going down a bad road. But most of the time, you know, when I've heard of saints discuss their connections with God, it's during meditative prayer in silence. That's where they feel that connection with God, when they're alone with their thoughts, when they can actually allow God in, you know, because their mind and their heart isn't being, the space in their mind and heart isn't being taken up by other things.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Amber, you know. And I think a lot of the time when people are discerning, when they're making a decision or something, you know, God is actually speaking to us all the time. It's just that we're not always taking the time to listen to what he's saying. And, you know, people very often, when they find themselves alone and in silence, they realize that they know the answer to their question already, that it's been there. God's been communicating it to them all along, you know, and it just that experience of silence and solitude is what allows them to connect with that answer.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
So, I'm a firm believer of taking, when we've got a dilemma or a decision in life, taking it to prayer. And in that prayer, we discern what we know already. You know, the correct decision is already there. It's just a matter of clarifying it, of coming to terms with it. And this doesn't happen, of course, through a lot of talking, you know,
right,
because talking is dialogue, multiple points of view all the time.
Right. I think also it's important because I believe it was St. Thomas Aquinas who said, like, talking too much is, like, not a sin necessarily, but it's not good. Like, I don't remember exactly who said it, but because the more you talk, the less you hear yourself and you just keep going and going and going. And there's no room for, like, response. And I forget who said that.
You know, I think it was actually St. Benedict. That's something that he mentions in his rule. He says, in much talk, you won't avoid sin. And
that's
this is something which Thomas Akempis talks about here. He talks about the dangers of long conversation. And he talks about all of the things that can emerge. And you think about, if you have a long conversation with a person, Not that that's always a bad thing, of course, but very often it's when gossip starts to pop up, when detraction, you start to talk about someone who you both know and find faults with them, when speculation, when you start to talk about, you know, what's going to happen, what's going to be the result of this. So there are a whole multitude of sins of speech. And we probably, most of the time, we don't consider them so serious as, you know, sins of action. But if you think about it, if we gossip about someone, if we detract from them, if we criticize them, if we damage their reputation, we're actually doing them an injury. And in the same way that we, you know, we would know it's a sin if you go over and punch someone or kick someone. Well, of course, it's also a sin just as much if you hurt someone's reputation through speech. And this is, I think, one of the dangers. The more time we spend talking with other people, the more likely we're going to slip into these things. And not only gossip and detraction, but also vulgarity and crudity and profanity and so forth.
I've noticed that as well, especially I've only really seen it amongst girlfriends because I think women can really fall into that trap of just bop, 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 bop. I've witnessed it with some men.
I mean, men do that too, though.
Yeah. The guys sometimes do it with themselves and it's just like, okay. But when the women do it, I find myself sucked into it because I'm like, wait, who did what? Like, I know her. Like, wait, what did she do? And then I'm like, wait. I'm like, nope. No, we're not talking about this. Or sometimes I just have to remove myself from the conversation because they're just going at it. And I'm just like, okay, I'm going to take a break. But yeah, I found the chapter you were talking about. It's on page 39. And I love this little quote right here. It says, "It is very rare to find any spiritual edification to result from a prolonged, colloquy? I can't pronounce words.
Yep. Colloquy. Yeah, like conversation.
Yes, indeed, unless there is a particular topic which is being discussed and a particular purpose for discussing it, it is almost inevitable that the conversation will slip into frivolity. I don't know these words.
Yeah, frivolity.
Or murmuring or gossip if it is sufficiently prolonged. See, I usually have Google with me to translate certain words. I'm dyslexic, so I'm like, I'm doing okay. But I think that's so true because I'll be out with a friend and for an hour, we'll just like catch up and we'll talk about specific things. But after that hour, we start going into like, oh, so updating you on so-and-so. And I'm like, ooh. And I've always noticed that after a couple minutes, it's just like, oh, now we're getting into other people's lives because we've already gone over our own lives. So now we have to go over other people's lives. It's crazy how that works.
That's right. And, you know, I think it's a part of it. I mean, it's a kind of human instinct, perhaps part of our fallen nature, to concern ourselves with, you know, other people's lives and other people's business, and normally not in a positive way. You know, often when we start to talk about other people, we don't talk about how great they are. You know, we start to pick out their faults and everything. And interestingly, within our Benedictine life, within our monastic life, you know, we have times of strict silence. At other times, we try to keep the conversation to not an absolute minimum. We're friendly to each other. We're sociable with guests and so forth. But at the same time, we don't go into very prolonged conversations, unless, of course, it's a situation of spiritual direction. And you can show just as much friendliness and care to another person through a short conversation as you can through a long conversation. You know, you can talk about a person, how they're going, how their life is and everything. And this can be done, you know, just as well in a few hundred words as it can be done in 10,000 words.
Right. And you know, I think that's because so
it's a gesture. It's a gesture of showing that we care, that we're interested. But there often is no benefit to prolonging these things. And I think we should be mindful of this in our interactions with other people, you know. And in monastic life, we talk to each other. We say, hello, how's it going? You know, talk about what's going on. But we don't have prolonged conversations as a matter of course.
Right.
And it actually works very well. Our communities tend to hang together well. Another thing, Benedictine monasteries, we don't talk about other monks as a general rule. So amongst the brothers, we all treat each other as equals. We're not particular friends with any one monk or any two monks, but we, you know, everything is just out in the open. We don't assume confidentiality as well. So anything we say to another monk, you know, is we're happy if it's passed on. I think that this is a principle which other people who are not monks can also usefully apply to their life. And it actually is a kind of empowering thing because it makes you in control of the information you're giving out, of the opinions you're giving out, and so forth, to realize that everything we think and feel in our heart doesn't necessarily have to be shared with someone else, you know?
I think it's always
shared with God.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's beautiful and why, you know, prayer journaling is so important, or just journaling in general, because especially for those of us who feel like we have to get the feelings out and things, the most healthy way to do that is through prayer journaling. But then there are some people where it's like, if you don't gossip with them, if you don't talk to them about this stuff, they feel like they're not your friend. I've ran into a lot of people like that, where these women, they'll be like, why aren't you talking to me about so-and-so or this or that? And, you know, as I'm discerning this and learning more about, you know, chastity of speech, or just, you know, boundaries, I should say, in general, the more I realize who I can trust and who I can't, and the more I'm realizing, like, this doesn't need to be said to this person, because then it's just going to fuel a gossip session somewhere else. And because I think venting sometimes for women gets convoluted, or I guess misunderstood with gossiping, because I definitely think, like, being able not vent about somebody, but about a situation, about something that happened, you don't have to mention names, is helpful for women. But I definitely have noticed that, like, if I don't gossip with some girls, they're just like, oh, you're not our friend, like, you don't trust us. And I'm like, yes, to the second one.
And you know, I see what you're saying, Amber, there. I understand it. Maybe a solution might be, when another person comes up, to talk about them positively.
Ooh,
you know,
that's not a bad idea.
And yeah, so, you know, when someone comes up in the course of gossip, you know, talk about what wonderful work they're doing, or, you know, how much you appreciate what they do and their company and so forth. And I think this is something we don't often do. You know, we when we talk about other people when they're not here, you know, I guess there's a general tendency to talk about them in a negative way for one reason or another. But to think, well, to look on people's good sides, I think this is a very important general principle in life. You know, not to judge others. That's really the role of God. And, you know, of course, sometimes we do need to vent or complain, but to be very judicious about the people who we do that with, you know. And for people in religious life, you normally have, as well as a confessor, you normally have a spiritual director or so forth. I think it's a good idea for lay people also to have someone who's like a spiritual director, if not necessarily a formal spiritual director, a person who they can share everything in their life with. And, you know, it might be your mom, it might be your sister, or whatever it might be, but someone who is preferably outside of the circle of the situation, you know. And this is why in monastic life, we normally have a spiritual director who's not a monk within our community, because what we need to talk about is probably things within the community. So it makes more sense then to vent with a person who is completely outside of that situation.
Yeah, I never really thought about that. I think also, you know, when people say all this stuff, I always think to myself, I'm like, never say this to that person's face. Because I feel like if you can't say it to their face, then you probably shouldn't be saying it at all. Because if you're fine with that going back and, you know, being able to say that in someone's face, that's one thing, I guess. And maybe you should have your anger issues checked out. But I definitely think that, you know, if you're not willing to actually say it to them, you shouldn't say it to another person. That's like my kind of, that's kind of how I've been measuring certain things as a introducing myself into this idea of just like, okay, not everything needs to be shared, because there is an issue, this pandemic of a lack of emotional chastity. I feel like everybody shares everything, especially online. I mean, there are trauma dump TikToks. There are women who just share everything about their lives, about their husbands, relationships, their kids. And these poor kids are just sucked into this hole of social media before they're even able to talk. And, you know, I think there is a real big issue of emotional chastity today. There's none of it almost. And I think books like this are really important to bring our attention to that and be able to be like, oh, hey, maybe this is something I need to work on.
Indeed. You know, and I think sometimes people overlook that we have God here as the ultimate person to whom we can confide. We can talk to God about literally anything at all in our life. We can tell him anything we feel because he kind of knows it already. And we can even like bounce ideas off God, if I can put it in that way. And I think that, you know, is a way of getting things out of our system, of clarifying things, you know. And this is where the prayer to God, the conversation with God, is so important, because if it's not there, then there's still this need to share, but, you know, it doesn't have a proper outlet. So people go to the internet because it's kind of like a quasi-God for them. It's kind of impersonal. They're not going to meet most of the people who they talk to on the internet. They're often anonymous. So they feel that, you know, this is not going to go any further. But I think that's a great mistake, you know. You know, as far as typing things on the internet, you may as well type things on just, you know, a computer that's not connected to the internet. It will do just as good. You'll be articulating yourself just as well. Or you might just write it down, or you might just say it to God. It's going to have just the same effect, you know. And this, you know, I think we need to view this kind of communication as a process of self-clarification. The reason that people communicate things is that they want to get their own ideas and feelings more clear to themselves. But the best way of doing this is actually through prayer, not through other people.
I think that's so profound.
And then this, and this prayer, you know, it makes us in relation with God more autonomous. So we're less than dependent upon our social network and so forth. And I think this is, it's for this reason that people who are of few words generally come across as being stronger individuals, generally come across as being wiser individuals than people who need to speak all the time. And I think coupled with this is an element of Christian charity, that people need others to listen to them.
Right.
And if we can consciously take on that role as the listener in social situations, in conversations, to go in and think, well, I'm going to listen to people. I'm not necessarily going to share my own opinions or my own feelings about these things. And that can do wonders.
I think that's really interesting, because also I've noticed as well, those who don't share as much, you know, those who don't share as much about their life, people are almost drawn to them in a way because they're unproblematic. They don't have these problems that they're making everyone else's problems. And I definitely think they're better listeners because they listen and then they're like, okay. And then people are like, well, are you going to like give anything back? And they're like, no, I'm just here to listen, because their problems aren't the world's problems. Whereas today, a lot of the times people just talk and talk and talk and they make it everybody's problem, whatever their problem is. So I think the people who don't speak as much, people are drawn to them because they don't have that many problems, or well, it doesn't seem like they do, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, yeah, even at a social level, this restraint in speech is a useful thing to cultivate.
Yes, I completely agree. And who would you recommend this book to? Like, is it for everybody? Do you think there's a specific niche that it's meant to meet? Or what do you think?
Yeah, so, you know, he talks about quite a few things here. He wrote this book for, I think it's fair to say he wrote it for young people. So someone who had requested him, you know, this thing of this piece of advice about being comfortable with silence and solitude. So, you know, it's probably best suited for people who don't have much of that in their life and perhaps recognize that, you know, I need to have more of this to then reflect upon how they interact with others, how they share on the sins which are associated with speech. So I would think that this book is really suited for young people who are part of this culture of over-communication, as well as people who feel within their heart a longing for solitude and silence, because it puts it in the proper spiritual context.
I think that's fantastic. And I've definitely gotten so much out of this book. So I'm so glad that you found it and you decided to translate it. Otherwise, we never would have known it existed, you know?
Yeah, thanks, Everett. It's been great to be able to share about this book and this very important theme with your listeners today.
Yes, I'm so excited that they'll be able to go out and buy this book. Guys, you can go buy the book Solitude and Silence, translated by Father Robert Nixon on Tan Books. And you can use my affiliate link in the description below for 15% off just to help out. But Father, thank you so much for coming on and being able to just speak to us about this topic. I think it's so important, especially in today's world. So just thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Amber, and may God bless you and all of your listeners today.
Thank you. And with all that being said, guys, I hope that this podcast has helped you, and I'll talk to you guys in the next one. Do you have questions or comments about today's episode? Email me at thereligioushippie@gmail.com or leave a voice message at anchor.fm/thereligioushippie. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Amber Rose and distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright by The Religious Hippie NFP. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for The Religious Hippie at thereligioushippie.com or find me on social media for other unique content.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis. In the 20th century, a new movement from the Far East captured the Western mind. Since then, the intersection of Christianity and martial arts has generated both conflict and harmony. In between, there remains many gray areas. In my new book, Jesus in the Dojo, I combine timeless theology with modern catechesis to provide a clearer path of reconciliation between the Christian faith and the practice of martial arts. You can find my book, Jesus in the Dojo, available now at most booksellers.